Thank you very much, Caroline. And thank you, everybody, for coming along to spend some time practicing with me this Sunday. It's really lovely to see you saying hello in the chat and hello to some friends. I know that there are friends I know here and also people maybe who I haven't sat with before. And yeah, I really appreciate these opportunities. So as Caroline said, we'll start today's time together with a meditation, and then I'll share some reflections with you and hopefully, well, definitely save some time for questions. So let's make ourselves comfortable to begin with and just really enjoy this time of being able to practice together with the support of a group, and I'll give some guidance to help us settle into a meditation. So we'll be practicing for about half an hour. Please choose a position that you can be reasonably comfortable in for that time, knowing that if you need to, you're welcome to move also. Just let that be part of your meditative practice. Okay. So I can see that people are still continuing to arrive. So as we settle down, really take your time to feel your way into a comfortable seat, with a sense of unhurriedness. And you can position yourself also in relation to your screen in a way that's comfortable for you. You don't need to be right up close to your devices. So you might want to, once you've kind of acknowledged where you are, to allow your eyes to gently close or soften your gaze. And to begin, just by feeling your body in the space that you're in. And so sensing the sounds around you. The sound of my voice, and also the sounds that are particular to your environment. It's an extraordinary way that we can all practice together in a shared space and simultaneously be in our own space. And sensing also the ground underneath you, whatever it is that you're sitting or kneeling or perhaps even lying on. Just noticing which parts of your body are in contact with the earth. And seeing if there are any little adjustments that you want to make so that you can feel better supported and better balanced. Really offering the weight of your body back to the support of the ground underneath you. This other mysterious, magnificent way in which we're all connected, all resting on the same earth, whether we're in Canada, Finland, Israel, wherever we find ourselves right now, all resting together on this same earth, all drawn together towards the middle of this same Mother Earth. And really beginning the meditation with giving yourself permission to rest. Whether it's early in your day or late in your day, savoring this time of non-doing. Knowing that the body knows how to relax, how to rest. So if there's an image of a place or an activity where you really know that you know how to rest, to relax, you might want to bring that to mind. So if you're resting down into a warm bath or your favorite chair. Letting yourself breathe out. All the cells of your body could breathe out. And then let the mind, the attention come to rest on the body, just as the body's resting on the ground. To being receptive to the sensations of the body breathing. In whatever way feels most natural for you. Not having to make a big project of it. And just feeling the aliveness inherent in your body, that sensation of touch with the ground, of the ground touching you, being touched. Of the breath breathing you, the body being breathed. Just moment by moment, sensing the gift of your aliveness. And of course, this gift of aliveness means that the mind is also alive. Thoughts and feelings come and go. And just in order to settle and let the system rest, seeing if it's possible to just let those thoughts and feelings come and go without following them. So it's not a problem that we might find ourselves experiencing thoughts. See if we can, just for these precious some minutes, this part of the day, refrain from hopping on the thought train. Stay close to the touch of the earth, the ebb and flow of the breath. So if you could keep that in the center of awareness and just let the thoughts move on the periphery. Feeling how much steadier it is to rest on the ground than to rest on a thought. And it's always helpful to be especially receptive to whatever feels soothing, steadying, even pleasant in this experience of just staying close to the breathing body. Maybe just the pleasantness of the mind not having to do anything right now. So if there's any feeling of enjoyment of this simple presence arising, let yourself soak it in. Noticing what's happening and seeing if it's possible to rest even a little more. Letting the body rest, letting the mind rest and settle on the body. It's as if when we do that, the heart can open a little more. The ears can open a little more. And start to fine-tune our awareness. Very, very gently receiving the sensations, the impressions of life unfolding moment to moment within us and around us. As we rest at the center. I'm feeling the ground underneath you, the space above and around you. And in the middle of this breathing, sensing body. And perhaps bringing your attention to your center, to your heart center, the area in the middle of your torso. And maybe sensing or imagining there's some warmth and some light there. Sometimes it's helpful to offer oneself an internal smile. As if a smile in the mouth or the corner of the eyes could just send its warmth down into the chest area. And then allowing that warmth to spread out and to include in our hearts the other people sharing this meditation with us. It's really this sense that we're practicing as one organism, one breathing body. Connected by this shared intention to be present in this moment, to listen to life with an open heart as best we can. Creating this network together through space. Across oceans. Across borders. One that is warm and spacious enough to include anyone else that we'd like to bring to mind, hold in our hearts this particular Sunday Sangha. Perhaps the power of our shared meditation is greater than the sum of its parts. Allowing that possibility. The beneficial energy of our practice can be a blessing and a balm and a support into all living beings. And to those that we know who we want to include, and maybe to others that we don't know. We're connected in all directions, below, above, and all around. And at the same time, each of us resting here in our center. So thank you for your practice. If you joined us later during the meditation, welcome. Really lovely to have you with us. So as the billing for this session said, my intention is to offer a few thoughts on the topic of faith, hope, and love on the Dharma path, which I realize after I said that is a very ambitious topic to try to play with in a half hour of reflections. But I think I was inspired by the fact that it's Easter Sunday, and being someone who was raised in a Christian environment or Christian culture, even though my parents were not practicing Christians, and I've got as much Buddhist ancestry as I do Christian, still, it touches me that this is the holiday that's happening here in the UK where I am, and at the same time acknowledging that, you know, many of you will come from very different cultures or faith traditions, and also from all around the world. So this is also a time of year when many cultures are celebrating spring, or we have festivals such as Passover and Persian New Year just happened recently. And in China, it's a tomb sweeping time. So, but this time of spring is really connected in many, many cultures with that sense of renewal and kind of the possibilities of the gift of life and the overcoming of despair and hopelessness, which is why the quality of hope seems to me especially a spring-like quality. And also really want to appreciate and acknowledge that there may be some of you here from the Southern Hemisphere, and it's a different time of year for you. But still, these qualities are really beautiful ones to reflect on. And I'm doing this really in a spirit of gratitude and appreciation also for all those of you who I've practiced with online in the past year, and those of you who've supported one another with your practice. And, you know, recognizing that this has been a very strange year for all of us, one with a lot of uncertainty, a lot of disruption, and maybe quite often feelings of disempowerment and hopelessness or despair. And then at the same time also that it's brought unexpected discoveries for lots of people also. It's interesting, isn't it, how when we're faced with uncertain or different circumstances, unexpected circumstances, new things appear and become possible. But one of the big tasks to me seems to be to really think about how do we keep the heart buoyant in the midst of all this, and that's not a luxury really, but a necessity. And these three so-called gifts of the Holy Spirit in this very famous passage in St. Paul's letter to the Corinthians, he talks about these three gifts of the Holy Spirit, of faith, hope, and love. And I really, it dawned on me that they are called gifts. They're not commandments, you know. They're actually capacities that we're gifted with as human beings. So they're not shoulds, but they're things that we have at our disposal that we can develop and that we can deploy. And that also makes me think how in Buddhist tradition, faith is the first of the five indriya or spiritual faculties, which again are gifts that we're endowed with as our birthright as human beings and that we can develop through using them. And as I said, this is a time of year, for those of us who are in springtime anyway, that's particularly suited to celebrating the gift of our aliveness, of which these qualities such as faith, hope, and love are an expression. And it is a big topic. So I just want to use one image really to explore this. And this was it's a memory that I have from when I was at school. And you know how sometimes there's a particular picture or a quote or a poem that you learn or something that you see that really stays with you through the years and the decades. And when I was at school, in the classroom where we had our maths lessons, there was a poster on the wall that I still think about and that really kind of made an impression on me. And it was a poster of a picture of the ancient Greek mathematician Archimedes standing out there in empty space on a planet of some sort. And in the distance was the planet Earth. And Archimedes was saying, as he famously said, "Give me a place to stand and I will move the earth." So this was one of the discoveries or theories that he was famous for, was his work on levers. He lived in about the 3rd century BC. And he was maybe one of the most famous mathematicians and engineers of ancient Greece. But he had this famous saying where he said, "Give me a place to stand and I will move the earth." And to a young person wondering what to do with their life, that was a kind of interesting kind of thing to ponder, because it sort of excited that sense of agency and possibility and the feeling that maybe we tend to have more when we're young, that the world is our oyster. If we could only kind of figure out where to stand and what to stand on. So particularly at a time when we might feel challenged and disempowered, you know, this has come back to me as an image. And then reflecting how it might relate to these three qualities of faith, hope, and love, was thinking that in order to accomplish something or move something, we don't only need a place to stand, but we also need space in which to move. And we need something to do the moving with. And I'd like to suggest that we could think about faith as the place that we stand, hope as the space to move in, and love as that with which we do the moving. So what does it mean to have a place to stand on? One of the things that's been really interesting for me and probably for many of you in this past year is the fact that we've literally been confined for periods to a particular place, and we've had to come into a different relationship to the ground underneath us, so to speak. I've really got to know the three square miles around my home a lot better than I did previously, and spent a lot more time going about on foot, not hurtling about, either in a car or anything bigger and faster. And there's something in our practice, as we were doing in the meditation just now, about feeling grounded, that really helps us find a stability from which we can see and which we can act. You know, when things feel very turbulent around us, we're often encouraged in our practice, and I find this really helpful, to literally feel the ground underneath our feet, to feel our sit bones resting on our seat, and to make just that kind of contact that I was encouraging in the meditation. And there's a sense in which the earth is always there and doesn't let us down. It's not going to go anywhere. You're not going to get away from it. And we trust it in order to move about, in order to go about our daily business. And then there's also, you know, something at a profounder level that we're invited as meditators, as practitioners, to put our trust in, and that's the Dharma, or the truth of the way things are. It gives us something that we can trust other than the force of our habits or our neuroses. So to really consider the fact of cause and effect in our world, to consider the value of ethical conduct, of training the heart and mind, of practicing generosity. And as we do this, we begin to see that actually some of these things produce more trustworthy results than simply, for example, trusting our every fleeting thought. How much more helpful it is to trust an understanding of the nature of thought, and the knowledge that some thoughts are worth picking up and some thoughts are not worth picking up, than it is to believe, put our faith or trust in every single passing thought. So this word faith, saddha in Pali, in the early Buddhist language, right, we can also think of it as confidence or trust or conviction. Faith is maybe a problematic word for some of us. It's connected with the idea of giving one's heart to something. So what do we give our heart to? What do we value? And also who do we trust? One of the things that gives rise to trust or to faith, again, in the traditional teachings, is association with wise and good people. We also need to develop trust in ourselves, or can develop trust in ourselves. And this emerges often from having a sense of self-respect, which brings us again back to that sense of and making skillful choices, having a sense of integrity about the way we go about our lives. So really being careful and choiceful about what we choose to take as our ground, what we choose to depend on. And then I'll just to come to the other part of the quote, give me a place to stand and I will move the earth. What is it to move the earth? Yes, sometimes we have big projects and beautiful dreams that we want to realize and that we seek guidance for, or the project that we might have of wanting to wake up, to understand, to actually realize the truth of some of these teachings. And sometimes there are moments where it feels like simply getting out of bed in the morning is moving the earth. And you may have cycled in the past year through all of those, ranging from the most sublime to the most small thing, really feeling like it's that would constitute in this moment moving the earth. So really wanting to acknowledge and include the times when, you know, simply getting out of bed in the morning is our moving the earth for the day, or doing the chores that need to be done, or showing up once more for our family or the people who are depending on us. This sense of I can do it, I'm willing to do it, or I'm willing to give it a go. And to really honor that and respect that also in ourselves. So faith, something to stand on. Hope. So saying that it's not enough to have something, a place to stand, we also have to have space to move into, or space to move in which to move things. So I was reminded of this. There's a beautiful passage in Stephen Mitchell's translation of the Taoist classic, the Tao Te Ching, which says, "We join spokes together in a wheel, but it's the center hole that makes the wagon move. We shape clay into a pot, but it's the emptiness inside that holds whatever we want. We hammer wood for a house, but it's the inner space that makes it livable. We work with being, but non-being is what we use." And I think that the way to really open space up in our hearts and minds and in our inner worlds, and then which creates possibility in our outer worlds, is when we really enter deeply into the present moment. When we really enter deeply into the present moment, we discover that it's forever changing. It's, in a way, it's ultimately ineffable. It's not something that we can pin down. Because the next moment, even the next micro moment, is always unknown. And this is what we forget when we fall into hopelessness. So this is the other side of the coin of the teaching of anicca, or uncertainty, impermanence, uncertainty, uncertainty being the necessary necessary consequence of impermanence. That uncertainty is not just something that is responsible for disappointment in our life, but it also is the source of possibility. So some words from the Zen teacher Norman Fisher, who says, "Hope is wisdom, the wisdom to realize that the next moment is always unknown. Bad things can happen, but good things can happen. I don't know and I can't know. Life isn't subject to my limited knowing. It isn't subject to my specifications for the future, but the future always comes. There's always a next moment, an unknown moment. And that moment is inherently hopeful. Hope is built into time. If you don't know that, then you could feel despair. Hope is necessary." So despair comes, I think, when we let ourselves get bogged down in an expectation of sameness. And it's, again, easy to do that sometimes with some of the circumstances that we're in at the moment. So our practice invites us to wake up out of that. In order to move, we need space. In order for the next moment to manifest, we need to let go of this one. This is why the breath is such a wonderful teacher in our meditation. In order to take the next in-breath, we have to let go of the previous one. This is almost a kind of microcosm for the whole of our life. Yeah. So we waste a tremendous amount of mental energy and stress trying to pin down an uncertain future. If you think about how much of thought is preoccupied with rehearsing for a future that never happens. The more we develop trust, the more we can let go into this future, making friends with uncertainty. So just to say that for Dharma practitioners, hope can be a kind of confusing idea because we tend to mix it up with want, and we're taught that grasping causes suffering. So when I'm talking about hope here, I'm talking about the sort of hope that is without particular expectation. So there are these famous lines from T.S. Eliot that talk about waiting without hope, because hope would be hope for the wrong thing. So I'm not talking about that kind of hope. But if you think about that quality of waiting, it is in itself intrinsically hopeful. It's waiting without expectation for life to unfold, but waiting with interest, waiting to receive what life has to offer for us, rather than waiting to get what we demand based on our previous expectations. And when our eyes are open, there's usually something to move the heart. So just today here in Oxford, I went out for a walk and the cherry trees are coming into blossoms. The magnolias are starting to bloom. There's something beautiful to move the heart that has nothing to do with my demands or my expectations, but is there to be simply noticed and enjoyed. And then this third quality of love. So Archimedes standing there, also in order to affect anything, you need to be connected to it. That seems to be the one other essential ingredient to me. And that came to mind again today. You know, you see something beautiful. What do you want to do? You want to share it. I think this is why many of us are prone to taking photographs of things when we notice them with our smartphones. And I saw these beautiful things and I photographed them and wanted to send them to my friends to say, Happy Easter. The heart just naturally wants to connect and share when it's not bogged down. So the other fun story that many people know about Archimedes is when he had this insight, he was trying to figure out a way about how to measure the mass of an irregularly shaped object. And he had this insight when he got into the bath and the bath overflowed, and he realized that he could measure the mass of his body by the, or the volume of his body by the amount of water that overflowed. And he was so excited that he jumped out of his bath with no clothes on and ran into the marketplace and said to everybody, I've got it, I've got it. So a silly story, but just another expression of the heart that wants to connect and share. And as we all know, this has been one of the really poignant challenges of this past year or period of our life, and one of the reasons that we value these platforms like Sunday Sangha and Sangha Live, where we can actually come together and connect, feel that connection. And I know some of you have really given a lot as well as received a lot to this particular online platform. It's a place where we actually can lend one another faith, we can lend one another hope, and we can lend one another friendship and warmth. And, you know, we each of us waxes and wanes in these qualities, but there's a way in which in coming together in Sangha, in community, we can borrow them, we can lend them, we can supply them for one another. And this has been one of my real experiences of Sangha over the years and association with teachers and friends on a Dharma path. So we also need to nurture a sense of friendship and support, not only with one another, but with ourselves. This is another point that I'd like to make about the quality of love and faith and hope, to use our practice to encourage, to create an internal climate of encouragement, to learn to speak to ourselves, to relate to ourselves, to care for our own hearts and bodies and minds with the same quality of care that we would offer to somebody that we love. And sometimes what opens the heart to this is suffering. So I don't know about you, but I would like to think that despite all the terrible things that we hear and read of in the news, that it's possible that the net amount of kindness in our communities and in the world has actually increased rather than diminished over the past year, if we could measure that. What's happened in your inner world? Maybe you've had occasions where you've been called to offer kindness. Maybe you've had to discover resources of self-kindness internally that you didn't know that you were going to have to tap into. Maybe you've been in places where you've really needed to open to receive kindness from others. And what a profound learning that can be, and what a profound gift to receive kindness from other people. So I wanted to just read to you the poem that many of you will have heard before, the poem by Naomi Shihab Nye on kindness, because I just think it's such a beautiful way of connecting with this quality. And what perhaps some people don't know, or many of us don't know, is the context in which she wrote this poem. So this poem about kindness that I'm going to read you was written on her honeymoon. She's a Palestinian American poet, and she and her husband went from the States to spend 3 months in South America on her honeymoon. And they were in Colombia on the first week of a 3 month honeymoon. And they were on a bus journey where they were all robbed and they lost everything, their passports, their money, everything. And one of the passengers was actually killed in this attack on the bus. And they arrived in the town or the village where they then stopped to get help. And somebody came up to her and simply talked to them about what had happened with great, great kindness, even though that there was nothing that they could immediately do. And then her husband had to go and leave for another town to try and get, you know, the necessary help so they could at least have papers and continue with what they were doing. And she was left all on her own. And she felt as almost as if this poem was dictated to her. She said, it wasn't like I composed this poem. It was just like I became the secretary writing down the poem. It was as if this poem was spoken to me in this place, in this situation, where she and the people with her had suddenly lost everything that they were depending on in that moment. So this is her poem, Kindness. Before you know what kindness really is, You must lose things. Feel the future dissolve in a moment, like salt in a weakened broth. What you held in your hand, what you counted and carefully saved, all this must go, so you know how desolate the landscape can be between the regions of kindness. How you ride and ride, thinking the bus will never stop, the passengers eating maize and chicken will stare out the window forever. Before you know the tender gravity of kindness, you must travel where the Indian in the white poncho lies dead by the side of the road. You must see how this could be you, how he was someone who journeyed through the night with plans and the simple breath that kept him alive. Before you know kindness as the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it till your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that ties your shoes and sends you out into the day to mail letters and purchase bread. Only kindness that raises its head from the crowd of the world to say, "It's you I've been looking for," and then goes with you everywhere, like a shadow or a friend. So I love that poem. There's something very humbling about it, and humble about its exposition of kindness, and that's really the most important thing, what we have left. And there's a way in which moving the earth is sometimes just that, tying our shoelaces, mailing our letters, going out to buy bread, to feed ourselves, to feed one another. And there's a way in which these qualities cycle around on one another, that actually when we live from that place, we connect again with faith, we connect again with hope. So just wanting to turn the heart towards these three qualities of faith, hope, and love as a kind of offering to us all on this particular Sunday Sangha, seeing them as a virtuous spiral that feed one another. And if it's something that you like, this image of Archimedes courageously standing out there in space, finding himself a place to stand and the possibility of moving the earth and the energy and something to move it with. So time flies. And let's pause for a moment and see whether there's any questions. So we have about 20 minutes of this session left for questions. And maybe before we do that, just to remember, a reminder for those of you who can't stay for any questions, just about the invitation to, if you can, contribute something to Sangha Live for this session that will also be shared with me. Your generosity is really welcome and helps to keep these sessions happening. So if you would like to do that, there's the green button at the bottom of your screen, and that's warmly appreciated. So, does anybody have a question coming to mind or a comment? You can use the question box at the bottom of your, again, also at the bottom of your screen. It's helpful if you can put them into the questions rather than type into the chat, because it's hard for me to keep tabs on everything. Aha. So, question about the quote about the clay jug and emptiness. It's from a translation of the Tao Te Ching by Stephen Mitchell, which I can actually type that into the chat. So we'll type him into the unfortunately, I don't have the chapter number, but it's not a huge thing to flick one's way through. I'm not sure if it's available online. I find it a text in which there's a lot of wisdom that's very compatible with Dharma teachings. So I know that for these sessions, oh, there's some questions that have popped up, sorry. Yeah. Okay. So just quickly to Margaret, the poet that I quoted was called Naomi Shihab Nye. And I think if you scroll back up the chat, a few people have mentioned her name in the chat. So yes, the question about hope, with respect to hope, not knowing can be an important source of hope. But what about dealing with continual drawbacks in activist work? For example, strategies for keeping the don't know mind alive. Yeah. In fact, the quotation that I read from Norman Fisher about the don't know mind actually came from an interview that he gave about climate activism, and which I actually I don't have the the reference for, but really recognizing that there are situations where we feel that the obstacles or the task is so great that it's very, very difficult to keep that don't know mine alive. It's like we need to bring a kind of almost continuous conscious effort to remind ourselves to not despair, to actually reflect on the unknowability of the future and kind of keep going. This is where the unconditionality of hope really needs to be brought to the fore, because we do, you know, the task seems so impossible and the setbacks are so repeated and continuous. And it's very easy to fall into, for the heart to fall into that kind of mode of hopelessness and inertia and losing the sense of possibility. But I think it really is the fact that we don't know what's going to happen next. We can't know precisely moment to moment what's going to happen next that we need in order to keep moving forward. And somehow that sense of it may not work out, but I'm going to do it anyway, you know, actually. So again, to the sense that the hope needs to be balanced with these qualities of faith and love, the willingness to trust, the willingness to give our heart to something, even though we don't know how it's going to work out. And that sense of connection, the sense of we're doing it for something greater than ourselves. You know? But I really recognize that the sense of hopefulness can feel profoundly challenged in some of these circumstances. But I think to give in to despair is the worst, you know, it's worse than the alternative. It's difficult. So a question here from Claire about how it's difficult not to attach an optimistic quality to the term hope, i.e. hoping for something better. And I think this is, again, this sense of optimism is like paradoxically, you know, I think in a way we can, and there is a certain wisdom to hoping for something better. In Dharma terms, in the sense of actually knowing when something more might be possible or discoverable than we know, knowing that actually a greater level of freedom or capacity or agency might be discoverable by us, that there's room for growth, you know. So that's different from hoping for something better out of a sense of aversion, that I don't like this, I want to get rid of this, and that's why I'm hoping for something better. I don't know if that makes sense, but, you know, if we're without aversion, then I think actually having the sense of more is possible is okay. So I would sort of advocate that flavor of hopefulness. Okay. just considering these. Okay. When we become aware of the part of our heart that's hurt and hardened and that doesn't want to release its pain easily, how can we deal with our own resistance to relax? Yeah. So I think it's, thank you, Sandy, for your question. And I think it's really important that relaxation is, it's not something that we can force upon ourselves. That even just acknowledging that hurt and the fact that we don't feel ready to let go of something, that we're resisting relaxation, or we're resisting letting go of something. Sometimes there's a certain amount of inner wisdom there that we need to trust that organismic knowing of when we're ready to let go and when we're not ready to let go, and to do so gradually. And sometimes that comes when we actually really start to see how in a particular situation it's costing us more to resist than to soften. But I really like the kind of images that talk about opening the heart as a process of opening and closing, and that there are situations where actually closing the heart in self-defense or putting up some kind of boundary is actually appropriate and skillful. And so without knowing the ins and outs of your particular situation or a particular situation, you know, I'm not advocating that we have to let go or can let go, or that it's wise to necessarily let go of everything all at once. Yeah. Sometimes self-protection is necessary, but what we don't want to do is get jammed up in that position. So it's kind of like prizing things open, allowing a little bit of softening and then a retreat, and a little bit of softening and then a retreat, and a little bit of softening and then a retreat. You know, we can relax around, or we can soften around the resistance that we're feeling. So you probably, many of you, familiar with this image of the multiple arrows, that something hurts, and so to get rid of it, we kind of, that like the first hurt is like a pain, it's like being struck by an arrow. To get rid of it, we fire another arrow, and then that doesn't work, so we fire another. It's like the heart is hurting and hardened, and so we harden around it some more, and then we harden around that. And that's the piece that we can start to soften. So we can soften the outer layers of resistance and gradually work our way inwards. And the other thing I'm noticing that several people have upvoted that question. And just to recognize that this is a predicament that is common to many of us in different situations. What does that do to the heart? So when we're hurting, to acknowledge, recognize that this is a part of our common humanity can also often help us to soften. Because we feel, when we feel less alone or less isolated, or that my particular problem, and of course each person's problem is particular, or you know, our the specifics of our situation are going to be particular to us, but actually the ways in which we suffer are often so profoundly human and so shared that actually connecting with that, with the sense of that this actually connects me with others rather than separates me from them, can also be a really helpful kind of medicinal understanding. Okay, one more question. I'll attempt to see whether I can respond to this one from Charlie. Oops, disappeared. Here we go. I understand faith as my practice and love as my appreciation of and devotion to the world around me. However, I'm struggling to frame an example of hope as it relates to the practice and the way it shows us to be with the world around us and within us. I know that I know it like it's on the tip of my tongue. Would you mind framing a simple example to remind me or us of how to use hope in practice? Okay, so let's just, I'm thinking even for example, about what it's like to show up in one of these Dharma sessions, either for me as a presenter or for you as a listener. You know, we come along with some sense of trust or confidence in the practice and some sense of love as wanting to offer ourselves to the practice, to the Sangha, to this path. And we don't know what's going to happen. You know, we don't know what we're going to hear, and we don't know what the heart and mind is going to make of it. And we can carry that not knowing forward with us. And we don't know what is going to manifest in the mind afterwards. And so again, you know, hope, if we're looking for something particular, then that kind of hope is maybe going to be thwarted. But we can also just be open to that sense of not knowing what's going to be revealed to us moment to moment. So that is the way that I'm really trying to invite us to orient to the quality of hope. So I appreciate that that may not answer your question, but that's what came to this heart and the mind in this moment. And I realize that our time is pretty much up, but let's take just a minute to sit together. And unfortunately, on this platform, I can't see you to take you all in, but just I'm sensing all of your presence, appreciating you there in the chat. Take a moment to appreciate yourself for joining for this evening or today's practice. And to sense the beauty of that shared aspiration and intention that we're all carrying. Feel your connection with the ground underneath you. And none of us know what's going to happen next. Thank you, friends, for your practice. I wish you a really good continuation of your day, and see you again.